Here we are with another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Hey, Sal, how's it going?
It's doing great.
I figured it was. I think I'm going to start saying, Sal, how am I doing? Because I already know how you're doing. You're great every time.
Another glorious day at Premier Ag.
Isn't it? And we've got Glenn in studio again. So one of our favorite guests, Glenn Longaball. How are you this morning, Glenn?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good deal. So we've got you in. We're going to talk about all things agronomy like we always do while you're here. But we're kicking you off here. Your question of the day today, Glenn, is what is your definition of success?
Context. Can you give me some context? Are we talking about deer hunting or are we talking about...
let's go with what you're
farming. Are we talking about agronomy or
your first passion, deer hunting?
Yeah. So then, I would have to admit that I'm a counter man. I'm looking for inches you like to have a good time and everybody likes to kill a deer or kill an antelope or whatever it is you're pursuing. But to me, it probably is more about, if it comes too easy. If you kill something the first day on a hunt and it comes too easy, you miss something out of it, right? You can kill a small critter at the end of a hunt, and it's oftentimes sweeter after you've scratched and clawed and gotten worn out. It's oftentimes sweeter than killing a really big one right out of the gate, right?
That's why you make it so hard. I mean, you're the one that put a zip line across. What river was that? So you could zip line out to the island.
Well, I can't disclose that because now you've already told me there's too many listeners. Somebody will go pilfer my trolley and cause me to have an accident. See, right now it's on the Skillet Fork River, and the Skillet's really low right now. So last week I did run over there one evening. I take Donna with me, so if it fails, I have somebody to call the ambulance or collect the pieces. But
he made a zip line to get to his.
Yeah, so this trolley, this wire, this cable is about 300 feet long, and it's not quite that long tree to tree. But when I get on the trolley in the middle of the Skillet Fork, I'm probably 30 feet over the bottom of the skillet, and it's only about this. It's only right now about
sort of like solid ground, probably right at the moment.
Yeah, six 6 inches of water is probably not going to break your fall. But what it would do is it would probably drown you when you lay there unconscious because you've just fallen 30 feet.
Got to fall on your back.
Well, that's the other thing is I do clip into a piece of super blue, synthetic rope. I've got a synthetic rope that I pull myself across with because you can't hardly reach up and grab the cable. And get across.
But, yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. I bought a hog to have something in the freezer, so I didn't. Yeah. I don't rappel or zip line.
Yeah, so this particular site, I hunt the far side of the Skillet Fork from what I call the near side or the east side, and that way I've got the prevailing wind in my favor. And I put this cable up because I was always getting shut out. Right about the time it got perfect, you'd get a big rainfall event or something. You couldn't wait it. And so I put this cable up and then build a trolley that you set on that works off of two little
nylon
pulleys. And basically you pull yourself across real, real slow. And when I get to the far side and I step off on the ground, I'm about 10 feet from my tree. And so what it affords me, which is really cool, is you can insert yourself and extract yourself without them ever knowing you're there, right? So you can hunt a bedding area, which is hard to do on white-tailed deer, right? I can hunt a bedding area and insert myself.
And you've not stepped on one stick to snap or anything.
I'll clear that path out to the tree. In fact, that's the first thing I did. When I got off the line, it's like there's little sticks and twigs everywhere. I just take my feet and rake it back and break off anything that I'm going to touch on the way in, and I keep it kind of so that they don't go around that side of the tree. It's the most unbelievable funnel I've ever hunted, and it's a great time.
That's what you can do when you have that much nervous energy that you've got to get rid of all the time.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it didn't happen. This didn't happen overnight. I found this probably 15 years ago, 20 years ago.
The biggest deer I ever shot ran at me, and I had to shoot him, keep him from running over me. And I disagree with you. I'm as proud of that deer as
there you
and
go.
I was only in the woods probably 10 minutes. So I felt like that was a win, but I don't like being out in the cold. So I was loading it and going. So
if
my truck was still warm.
If I can't shoot them in the yard or get a backhoe or loader tractor to it, I don't want to mess with them.
I put several through the front of my trucks. I get no satisfaction out of those.
Yeah.
None.
Yep. None. Yeah, you hate to see those. I hate to see them hit. That's for sure.
Yeah. So. But, Sal, oh, what's your definition of success?
It's kind of, I guess I'll go with kind of with work, I guess, and kind of the win-win situation. We had to talk about that this morning. You know, we're looking at autonomous sprayers, and is this something that the grower benefits from, that Premier Ag benefits from? Does, you know, how does that work together? And that's how we kind of go to market at Premier Ag. Just is, you know, don't believe in a zero sum, believe in making more. And that's not a canned answer. It just feels better whenever, you know, the grower wins, we win, and we return some to our shareholders. So cool. Easy peasy.
Well, yeah. Well, I hate to knock you off that fence you're riding on, but that,
it's not a zip line or anything. Well,
that's true. No, I think my definition of success has always been, you know, obviously we have some selfish reasons why we want to be successful and things that we want to do. But if I think success is having someone say to you, "Hey, I appreciate what you did for me. I appreciate a door you opened for me, or a piece of advice you gave me," or so I think at some point in time, being a mentor and or being a positive influence on someone would be my definition of success. So
that's well done.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You definitely got the most exciting story of success, though, with the zip line 30 feet above the river.
Yep.
We always let him go first, and he always has better stuff than we've got. So.
Well, I always ask you to put context on it, right? Every time.
And, that's true.
And you don't, you always want to go for the coon crap or the most obscure.
Tuna right? cans.
It's never around, you know, my professional role. It's always these obscure things. It's what you want me to elaborate on. So,
well, let's bring it back to your professional role. So absolutely. Let's talk about our latest pathogen, tar spot,
yeah,
in corn. So we're just going to do like Ryan says, and tar spot, go.
So tar spot is, you know, it's a disease that we've had now in Indiana for probably half dozen years or so. And it's native to Central America. And yet it's right at home here in the Central Corn Belt. And you would think that, you know, it'd need warmer climates, but it thrives in this climate.
Dumb question. How did it get here and just show up in the last half a dozen years?
I mean, you think about it. This is a world economy, right? You guys have listeners probably in South America, and we trade commodities all over the world. Yeah, you know, it's amazing to me that APHIS, you know, keeps up and keeps pests and pathogens at bay as well as they do, right? Because, I mean, you think about our grain and where it ends up, it is all over the world. So
explain what you just said to our readers. What did you just say?
Yeah, so the folks that look after, right? So when you go through customs, when you leave the country or you come into the country and they ask you if you have any agricultural products, right? And you're like, "No, I don't have any agricultural products." Well,
but yet you got a banana in your...
You got a banana in your suitcase or in your carry-on. You know, you could potentially be carrying a pathogen or an insect or some kind of critter that in a different environment could become epidemic or become, you know, a really noxious pest, right? And so we have agencies that look after that in the U.S. and other places in the world try to keep that at a minimum, right? I got caught one time. I say caught... you know, I came back from Africa on a bow hunt, right? Because you guys know I'm passionate about bow hunting and love to chase critters and stick arrows through poor defenseless critters all over the country if I can.
And the world, apparently.
Yeah. And one year we came back and really we had nothing to declare, right? We were on our best behavior. And yet in my quiver was a broken arrow from a critter that I had shot that still had blood on it.
Oh.
They recognized that right quick. And of course, you know, they confiscated the arrow and that was fine. It was not a big deal. I mean, it was a broken arrow. But that tells you that we have dedicated men and women that are out there trying to ensure that we don't bring, you know, some obscure disease into this country.
Wow. Right? Okay.
So
we don't know, but yet there's a lot of different ways it could have got up here.
Absolutely. And probably, you know, it probably came, you know, we do breeding work in South America, just like South Americans. I actually have a plot on my farm. It's a company that bought FFR. You know, you remember that site up there by Lafayette? and it's called Agrible, and they do testing for South American seed companies. It's their winter production, which is our summer production, and they come out and do, you know, they rent basically a packet plot, so they'll put a couple, you know, maybe 1,000 varieties out there, 16 half-foot rows, and basically they come in and harvest it with a plot combine. They do all the planting, all the harvesting. Hmm. A lot of times I'll do the weed control, but yeah, that's it. It's possible that it could have came through something like that. But the epicenter was up there in that, it'd be that irrigated area of southwestern Michigan and northwestern Indiana. That's kind of where it started, if you remember. And it blew up really quickly there, and it does overwinter here. And yet we in southern Indiana have been a bit unscathed, right? And I think that's possibly because we've had other pathogens like southern rust for some time, right? In 2016, 2017, mm-hmm. we had some really bad epidemics of southern rust that changed our growers' behavior, right? We like to believe it's because we did a better job of consulting, and yet it probably ultimately was the fact that there were some huge yield losses in those years because of southern rust. That changed our behavior and how we treat corn crops with fungicide, and because we are treating for southern rust, it has mitigated our losses to tar spot. But tar spot, you know, if tar spot came in earlier, I'm telling you, it would be without question our worst pathogen here, right? It, fortunately, even though it overwinters here and has the ability to infect earlier, it doesn't seem like it normally comes in until corn gets into the R stages, right? And typically we're at R1, R2 before you see any lesions. And so consequently, after it goes through a life cycle, right, it's a polycyclic disease, which means it goes through multi-cycles per year, just like a lot of our other diseases do. This polycyclic disease has a longer latent period, right? In other words, that time from infection to actually seeing the vegetative structure, in this case, it's called a stromata. It's like a little black raised spot, right?
The symptoms.
Till you see the symptoms is a little longer window than it is, say, with like southern rust.
How long is that?
Yeah, it's typically, I should know that, but it's more like 3 weeks, right?
Did I do it?
I can't get
it. You did it.
Yep, I can't tell you the actual latent period.
Let me wait. Mark that down.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah. Glenn, 76,000.
Yeah. I don't want to tell you
one.
Yeah. Well, I don't want you got a lot of listeners. I don't if it's 18 days or 22 days or whatever, but I think it's about 3 weeks. Where a lot of diseases, you know, we're talking about northern or GLS or southern, oftentimes, you know, it's a fairly quick period, right? It can be as little as 12 to 14 days, right?
Okay.
So this has a little longer latent period. But man, I'm telling you, when it must be an incredibly prolific sporulator, because, you know, like with GLS, it takes multiple generations oftentimes to actually predispose the plant. With tar spot, right, the initial infection makes a few black, you know, bumps on the plant, right? These little fruiting structures. The subsequent generation completely predisposes the plant, right? So you see a few spots out there and you're like, oh, it's good. We've got this under control. Maybe not, right? If it sporulated and the next infection has already set up housekeeping, it will probably predispose that plant just almost overnight. So I've shown pictures in the wintertime from Darcy to Linko, right, where it shows corn that looks like it's got a few infections on it, you know, like the last week of September, and by the first week of October, it is completely and totally dead, right? You know, you go from green to a completely necrotic plant in less than 2 weeks, right? So it has the potential to be a terrible disease for us. Again, we have done a great job of managing because we are sensitive to southern rust, right? And I'm not convinced that every manufacturer is making the right recommendations, right? So if you look at BASF's recommendations versus Bayer's recommendations versus Syngenta's recommendations, versus Darcy Filenko's recommendations, right? There's this discrepancy of when and how to treat these diseases. And it's because we don't, it's not in a vacuum. Oftentimes in the real world, we're down here treating not just southern rust or not just tar spot. We also have physoderma. We have gray leaf spot, right? We have northern. We have all these other, we have this plethora of disease that we're trying to mitigate. And so that changes the timing versus a Dr. Filenko up at Purdue that is intentionally trying to encourage tar spot. So she plants later, right? And because she wants as much infection as she possibly can. And by the way, we need that, right? That's why academics are academics, right? We need her to figure out how to get the best control, what are the best products. But in doing that, she basically farms differently than the way we would farm out here.
She self-selects for tar spot.
Almost. Absolutely. Absolutely. Boy, that's good.
You like two? Is that a two?
That's, yeah, wow. Put down another.
Another mark.
Wow. Yeah, put down another mark.
Why don't you just take the rest of the day off?
I feel like I've done. So maybe I've added to the confusion, right? I don't feel like my recommendation has changed. And so there's a fair amount of pride here, right? I oftentimes do change my opinions, right? Because I feel like, we don't know everything about agronomy, and I certainly don't know everything about agronomy. And occasionally there is new evidence brought to light that suggests that maybe we haven't been managing right. But we haven't really changed our story. You look back when I worked for Syngenta, I don't think my story of when we should probably make fungicide amendments has changed much, right? So we have often encouraged growers to make a V-stage application followed by an R-stage application, right? And that R-stage application, we have been backing that up a little bit. As opposed to R1, we're encouraging growers to wait maybe till R2, R2.5, maybe even R3, to ensure that it lasts long enough to get you to physiological maturity. And so maybe I've added to the confusion because, if you started R1 and you work this thing forward, right? R1 really, Ryan, should be probably R0, right? R1 is silking. R1 is about halfway through a plant's life cycle, right? So at R1 to physiological maturity, you're talking 8.5 to 9 weeks, right? And, a lot of times we talk in days, and I think that's another thing that makes it confusing. So, maybe we should work this backward, right? So if it's 8.5 to 9 weeks to physiological maturity, and we know that if you can get corn to within 2 weeks of physiological maturity, there's little or no appreciable yield loss, even if a disease sets up housekeeping, right? And the reason being is at 2 weeks of physiological maturity, right, what we would call a full dented ear, at that time, you've only got about 5% of your biomass is still going to be accumulated, right? And so even if the corn was killed dead in a mackerel at that stage, the worst it could probably get hit is 5%, and probably it's going to partition or reallocate photosynthate from other parts of the plant to actually fill the ear. So it's still mitigated, right? It's probably only 2.5 or 2%, right? So that gets us to, let's say, 7 weeks. And when you consider that these top-tier fungicides that we're using today, right, and I don't want to leave anybody out. So if it's Syngenta, it's probably going to be a Trivapro or a Miravis. If it's the BASF folks, right, they've got a great product called Veltima. If we're talking about Bayer, it's Dallaro Complete. These top-shelf fungicide products, right, these top-tier products, they don't just last a couple weeks, right? It's not like chlorothranil that you used early in your career, right, that lasted till the next rainfall event. These products are typically good for 3 to 4 weeks, right? So if we know we're good 2 weeks from that, physiological maturity range, and we know that fungicides last 3 to 4 weeks, right, that puts us that gives us some clue as to when we need to make that second fungicide application to get us to physiological maturity with little or no appreciable yield loss, right? And that would be 3 weeks. So what is 3 weeks? Well, at R1 is silking, right? That'd be like zero.
Mm-hmm.
R2 is blister. That's typically 7 to 10 days down the road. R3 is milk. That's another week, right? So now we're talking 2.5 weeks. We needed to get to 3 weeks. Doe is about 2 weeks past blister, right? And so it's somewhere between milk and doe. And so if we can make R2.5, R3 applications, our likelihood of getting pinched by either southern rust or tar spot is greatly reduced. Now, you're probably saying, but hey, man, when we get to flowering, we oftentimes have disease. We do, right? But those diseases are typically pretty easily controlled even without using top-tier products. But if we do use top-tier products or we'll use mid-tier products, if we'll make V-stage applications, right? Now, I'm not talking about V4, you know, little teeny tiny corn. But if we'll wait until the corn gets into grand growth, which we're oftentimes making nutritional amendments and that sort of thing, those applications can easily get you to flowering with little or no disease. And you're probably saying, well, how is that possible? I thought they only last 3 weeks. Well, they do only last 3 to 4 weeks. But the beauty is when you control disease early, when it's setting up housekeeping, things like northern and gray leaf spot, they make a jump, right? They have been living, overwintering on the residue as a saprophyte, which means that they're living on decayed material. When they make the jump onto the plant, right, they are not very robust. And so if you can control them when they make that initial leap onto the plant, then you have made a huge impact on the subsequent generations, right?
And you break the life cycle.
Yes, you break the life cycle and you make it start over and it works from the bottom to the top. And so that's why these V-stage applications are so effective, right? Whether we're talking about V6, V7, V8, making applications at that time when it looks like there's little or no disease still have a profound impact on when those diseases come in. And if they don't come in at R1, right, when you make a V-stage application, most of the time you get out there at R1, the plant is just spotless. So do you need to make an R1 application? Nope. Then you can delay it to R2, R2.5, R3, and then you have little or no chance of losing yield. So the strategy, though it sounds really complex, is very forgiving, right? I mean, whether you make it this date or next week, it probably is going to be there's probably a fair amount of luck involved, right? Because the fungicides are pretty effective and diseases, right? We don't do a very good job of predicting when they're going to happen. But if you go at this prophylactically and make multiple applications, typically 2 applications, I think you're always in our part of the world, right? We've talked about raising big corn on purpose, not accidentally raising, you know, 260 bushel corn, but I'm talking about raising corn, you know, big corn crops on purpose. Making 2 fungicide applications is almost table stakes, and it really relieves a lot of risk, right? It's really about risk management. Because if you think about what we have, I mean, the growers that don't, or the listeners that don't farm, I probably have no appreciation for the amount of money that a farmer has invested per acre.
Go ahead. This is a good time to, so, and we'll circle back to this, the prescription, but go ahead and kind of tell them how much is out there. I mean, when you're talking about risk avoidance to try to protect your crop, and like you said, not get pinched at the end.
Oh, absolutely. So if you're fertilizing a crop and you're paying, a decent rent to your landlords and you're putting on crop protection products to protect that crop and you're putting on nitrogen, it is easy for a grower to get in excess of $1,000 an acre, right?
Yeah.
In that crop. I mean, it is very easy. In fact, I would say the majority of acres today have more than $1,000 gross tied up, invested in that crop. And you're saying, well, gee, you know, you're raising 250 bushel corn. That may be true, but not every acre is 250 bushel corn. And the other thing is, you know, I made a comment to you, you know, Sal's my boss, right? Just like you're Sal's boss. I think that's how this works. I told him the other day, it's like, well, I have lost, if I thought I was going to have any sovereignty this year because I had this great big crop, and you know, any autonomy that has gone away, I'm pretty sure I'm going to have to work forever because that crop that was so big, has lost about, you know, 25% of its value from this summer, right? And, you know, $4 corn, it takes, you know, at $4 corn, it takes 250 bushel corn
to break even.
Yeah, to break even or make any money at all.
Well, we hate it that your hands are tied, but
yeah. That's kind of a weird feeling. Talk about that definition of success.
You're right. Yeah. This is it. Right. Yeah. To have an agronomist that can't go anywhere. Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's, you know, it's obviously not quite that ugly, right? We all, you know, farmers like to sandbag like everybody else, right? Because there's nothing worse than getting your hopes up. And that's kind of what happened, yeah. Right? You had $6 corn a big part of the summer. Looks like, you know, we started getting rainfall. It's like, hey, we're going to have a crop, and maybe the Central Corn Belt's not. And then, of course, the Central Corn Belt's crop ends up being better, and they keep revising. In fact, I think there's a WASDE report.
We're going to talk
today.
About that
yeah.
later. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm sure they'll beat it up a little bit more. But, yeah, we can't get off on commodities. And you talk about agronomy and you know, I don't think our story here at Premier or my story has changed on the timings, but I know it's difficult for me, and I think it's difficult for a lot of people to if we're making a diagram or a schematic of when to make applications. This is all temporal, right? It's hard to picture time. I don't want to get into a thing about our vice president and the significance of time. And
oh my gosh, that'll make the comments. If we weren't going to get any comments, now we'll get.
I'm going to act like I didn't hear it.
Yeah,
I'm just going to glaze over.
Yeah, so we won't go into that. What do they call that?
The passage of time is pretty important.
Yeah. So, but it is hard. You know, when we think about these applications. It's not like, oh, we have the disease. We're going to make the application. We cured it. Now it's good, right? That was the way we managed with IPM, and we still try to practice IPM as best we can. But when you consider that when you see...
IPM is integrated pest management, meaning that you see the problem before you treat it.
That's correct. Right.
Ooh,
yeah. Great. Outstanding, Ryan.
Ryan,
give yourself half a point for that because you're friends with me.
Okay. So yeah, you know, it's not that we don't like to follow integrated pest management, but if we wait until we see the lesions, because this crop is so valuable and we're no longer trying to raise 150 bushel corn, right? We're trying to raise 250 bushel corn on purpose. You can't very well do that by waiting every time until, by the way, you wait on some pathogens until you see the fruiting bodies. They've already sporulated, and you now have a full-blown infection, right?
Can I stop you for just a minute? Back sure. up. Just when you said that the yield on tar spot, you can mitigate it by making your fungicide pass late enough. So for my ignorance and hopefully somebody out there that's listed doesn't know the answer to this either, you're talking about though ear fill and all that. So what about stalk integrity that goes along with these kind of diseases? Obviously there can be yield loss there at some point in time. So 2 weeks out from physiological maturity may not save the stalk. Am I right? Am I asking that correctly? I mean,
yes, I think I see where you're going with this. By the way, have you been snooping around on my phone? Because just yesterday, I made a diagnosis, right? in the Premier companies, I've got an account rep that has had a grower with corn that has fallen down in spots, right? And the way you described it, it's like, yeah, you've just got crown rot. And I thought it was kind of unusual because it was a dry spring and this area had been fairly dry. And it's like, you know, what's the likelihood that crown rot would be that bad? But, you know, maybe he's got really high populations. Maybe these are springs or wet areas. And yesterday he sent me some photographs of it, and very quickly, you know, when I expanded the picture, it's like, oh my word, right? And he had stalk split too, and there was some crown rot there, obviously, but that wasn't the primary culprit. The primary culprit was tar spot.
Wow. Right?
When you could see the stromata, these black spots, even on necrotic, you know, dead leaves out in a cornfield, you can see it today. In fact, it's everywhere. Right. So our strategy of protecting these plants, you know, through the majority of grain fill was absolutely effective. But it doesn't eliminate the disease. Right. The disease still comes in. It's just coming in so late that it no longer impacts yield. And hopefully it's late enough that it doesn't impact standability. So to your point, Ryan, this particular grower had pockets in the field that were just totally necrotic and completely completely lodged, right? In other words, the plants had broken, and part of that was diplodia, but a big part of it was just the fact that tar spot had come in, predisposed the plants, you know, killed them prematurely, that plant then tries to compensate, right? Because it was designed to fill that ear, right? That's how it proliferates, or that's how it creates the next generation, is by creating viable seed. You kill a plant off prematurely, you kill the vegetation off prematurely, it tries to do everything possible, right? Sacrificing standability, because, you know, that's not the design, right? No. We select for standability, but that's not what it was designed. It was designed to create seed.
So now we've got it. It's out there. It's on the residue. What do you want to do with the residue? What is our plan now? Do we rotate out for a year or two? Do we work? We obviously, do we work it? We bury it down?
Yeah.
What's your recommendation?
Yeah. So if you're going to go corn on corn, then absolutely working that residue down will help mitigate some of the inoculum, right? When we think about the disease triangle, there's three things, right? It takes you know, favorable environmental conditions, right? It takes a susceptible host, right? And the third thing it takes is inoculum, right? And so when you make you know, these tillage passes, right? When you work the residue into the ground, you're trying to reduce the inoculum. You don't eliminate the inoculum, right? But you do reduce it. So in our part of the world, we do a lot of conservation tillage, and you know, we're trying to hold the soil. So we're not encouraging people to make you know, more tillage passes. And so in that case, what you would do is you would rotate to soybeans, because it doesn't infect soybeans, and hope that during that time that you know that it can't over you know it can't make it through two seasons as a saprophyte, right?
But generally, so we're still going back to your prescription, but generally we are in that rotation. I mean, we do have a lot of corn on corn, particularly out in the western part of our territory, but generally we are in a corn soybean rotation, but we still see this. Is that because it blows in once the...
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not like southern rust, right? Southern rust overwinters in the south, right? And then it blows up here with storms. This overwinters here, just like grazily spot, just like northern, just like Physoderma. The difference would be that it typically sets up housekeeping a little later in the year, right? And so if it came in earlier, I'm telling you, we would probably have to change our strategy. But wow. But the way we're using fungicides today, we're doing a pretty decent job on tar spot. We haven't had anybody... If they've kind of followed this regime of making a B stage application followed by a delayed R application, you know, last year, one of the things that changed was we were so dry during the when we normally make V stage applications, we were so dry that some folks didn't make those applications, right?
Yep.
And then when we got to R1, they did have gray, they did have northern, they did have Physoderma, and so they couldn't delay that R stage application. They had to make an R1, and then they had to turn around and come right back at R4, you know, which normally is pretty late, but they had to make a second application for fear of tar spot or southern rust setting up housekeeping. And so I'd rather not lose any of that. Even though the majority of it is on the bottom of the plant, I'd rather not lose any photosynthetic capacity early on, right? Because you know, I say early on, when we get to the R stages, I'd love to have a perfectly clean plant at that time if I could.
So which vegetative stage to make the early application? V8, V9, V10?
Yeah, anywhere from V6 to V10. Okay. Obviously, we want to follow label restrictions. There are some restrictions because you can... oftentimes, it's not the fungicide that can cause arrested ear syndrome. It's the adjuvants that we use with it. But, you know, there's listeners here that don't know whether their adjuvant system contains nonyl phenyl ethoxylates or these NPEs that often are associated with arrested ear syndrome, right? So, you need to follow label instructions. I can tell you that it's typically not the fungicide itself that causes arrested ear syndrome or seed production, which they, you know, in seed production, they'll run fungicides, not weekly, but probably every couple of weeks, they'll run a fungicide across it, trying to, because those are typically inbred lines, right?
Yep.
The offspring are, you know, have a lot of heterozygosity, right? They have a lot of what we call hybrid vigor, but the inbred lines in production seed are, you know, they're inbreds, right? They don't have a lot of vigor.
Yep. Right?
They have an absence of hybrid vigor.
And we use Master Lock. That's one of the that's the product we use. So in the vegetative state, then come back, and hopefully that gets us to R2.5 to R3.
Absolutely.
With a top tier fungicide to finish out.
Absolutely. And like I said, there are some wonderful fungicides, right? They, you know, it wasn't that many years ago that we were reliant on, you know, kind of this first generation triazoles and Strobilurin products.
Tilt.
Yeah, basically propiconazole, Tilt. And today we have kind of second generation triazoles and even this azole from BASF. Is really, really a wonderful product, a great addition, and that's, you know, that and genetic gain and doing a better job of feeding plants and being conscious of in-season nutrition, all those things together have made us grow really big crops on purpose, right?
Yeah.
That's all I've got.
That's all I've got.
Very good.
All right. Thank you, fellas.
No, thank you very much. We appreciate having you, and all good information for sure.
It's my pleasure.
Okay. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. If you like what you see, please subscribe to the channel and hit that like button. We'll see you next round.
Thank you.